Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about filmmaking, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today is going to be a diary episode featuring yours truly. Every other week, I hop on the mic and share some things about what's going on in my life, as well as my thoughts on what's happening in the world. And in the weeks that aren't diary episodes, I try to have an interview episode where I speak with someone interesting in the world of film, television, art, culture, artists, writers, etc. You can find more episodes of the show at culturallyrelevantshow.com, email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com, or follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. This podcast is made possible by patrons at patreon.com/DaveChen. Thanks to everyone who's contributed to allow me to keep pursuing my passion of podcasting to you on this show. All right, so much has happened in the last week, and I'm going to be honest about today's episode, which is that typically I spend quite a bit of time prepping for these diary episodes. I read lots of articles. I have all the articles queued up on my desktop, and I'm like ready to go, like reading some clips from them and, you know, ready to link to them and so on. And I honestly just haven't had time to do that this week. I recently started a new job on a new team. And I'll just say that it's been very, very intense at work. I am exhausted every single day. Working at a rate that is unsustainable right now. So I'm hoping things will calm down at some point in the foreseeable future. But it really has left less time during weekdays to work on podcast things or create things during weekdays, which is when I usually like to record and release this podcast. So if today's podcast is a little rougher and shorter than usual, just know that that is the reason why. But in terms of what's happening in the world, obviously you know what's happening. I mean, I don't need to tell you. In the time since an episode of this podcast was last released, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. There's obviously a huge battle right now going on over whether, if, how she is replaced on the U.S. Supreme Court. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, has refused to acknowledge that he will allow for a peaceful transition of power. He's refused to say that he will recognize legitimate election results. That's going to obviously create a challenging, probably dangerous situation come Election Day in a few weeks. And in the United States, we have now passed over 200,000 people who have died from coronavirus. 202,700 people, according to the latest count from the New York Times, and over 7 million infected. If you look at the chart of coronavirus deaths at the New York Times coronavirus website, which I'll link to in the show notes, I mean, it is really discouraging. You know, you see this initial curve, and then like every other country went down, you know, and then we kind of didn't go down. We leveled off. And then there's a new curve that goes up, and then it's starting, like, it's even higher than the first curve, and then it's starting to go down and level out again. And kind of where we are is that second leveling out again. And it's just really not what you want to see in one of these curves, right? You want to see it go up and then go down, and we have gone up and then plateaued and then got up again and then kind of plateaued. It's horrifying to look at the chart. For everyone out there who's dealing with this, which is the overwhelmingly vast majority of you, I hope everyone out there is staying safe, staying healthy, doing what you can to protect yourself and those around you, wearing a mask, being compassionate and reasonable to everyone. Please keep doing what you're doing. I wanted to talk about something that's happened in my life, which is that we have started to form a COVID bubble. I've talked about this, I think, on a past episode of the podcast, but a friend of ours has moved in to the house next door, and we are creating a COVID bubble. And I want to talk a little bit about how this works. I think it might be interesting to people to hear about like the mechanics of how this works. But essentially, forming a COVID bubble, or as my co-host on the Slash Filmcast, Jeff Cannata, puts it, agreeing to share your germs with someone else is a tricky proposition because it requires essentially that you and the other person are the same level of carefulness. And that can be difficult to pull off because, first of all, people don't like to ask about each other's level of careful. Like, it's a challenging thing to talk about, you know? It's like talking about money. It's like you don't necessarily want to bring it up in polite conversation. Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't care about conversational nicety, so I'm happy to bring this thing up. So anyway, so let's say I have the same level of carefulness as some of the friends who I want to form a COVID bubble with. And the benefits of the COVID bubble are that you get to see each other. You get to interact and then presumably like hang out without worrying about wearing masks or things of that nature. Now, but let's say I've identified these people. First of all, you need to codify what it is that you are all doing to not get the coronavirus. And so I have a COVID bubble worksheet here, a guide here that I'll just read from. This is a document that we prepared and circulated to people who are in our bubble, which is like still, by the way, in the process of forming right now. So I haven't gotten permission to read this entire document because I didn't prepare very much for this podcast episode, but I'll read from what I have here. So COVID bubble guide: free to socialize with others who follow the COVID bubble guide. Practice social distancing with those outside the COVID bubble guide by wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart. Now, I'll just pause there for a moment. Like, if you wear a mask and you stay 6 feet apart, some people are saying, like, you know, you can droplets can travel up to like 10, 12 feet. But I think if you wear a mask, if you stay 6 feet apart and you're generally outdoors, which is also implied by this, that like you're probably fine. Okay, public distancing. Here it is. Avoid places where social distancing is not possible and wear masks in public places. Needless to say, wash hands frequently. Use food delivery instead of in-restaurant dining. Use grocery delivery instead of in-store shopping. Drug stores, doctor visits, and other necessities are fine with face mask, hand washing, /gloves, and social distancing, etc. Okay, anyway, it goes on. But we essentially have a COVID bubble guide, and it kind of codifies all the things that we agree on. In addition to this, I have created a shared Google worksheet where everyone in the bubble logs any activity that occurs that is potentially risky. So any activity that takes place outside your house, you saw friends, you went to the grocery store, you went to the doctor, these kinds of things. I believe in like the fullest of disclosure. So I think that if you are sharing your germs with other people, like everyone just people deserve the right to make informed decisions about how they're proceeding. So anyway, we have this shared Google sheet, and that way everyone, anytime you take any action that might be considered a risk, you log it on the Google sheet and then you can go from there. People can say, hey, I'm not okay with that. I'm not going to see you for a few days or for a couple weeks or however long. Or they can decide, hey, okay, I understand what you've been up to and I accept that you took this risk and I'm fine that you took this risk and, you know, I'm fine with the risk as well. So that is how I am in the process of forming this COVID bubble. And we had our friend move in. And I'll probably be like making videos with her soon and talking a little bit more about the bubble and how we did it. You know, like it's probably going to be some kind of source of content for me in a way that like I don't mean that to sound like craven. I think like just people are interested in understanding how this works. And I think like there's just to my estimation, very little out there about how to do this well. So I feel like it can be a resource for people. Anyway, so I'll be talking more about it in weeks to come. But our friend moved in. We've started forming the bubble. And already, it's been awesome, I just have to say. I think because just knowing there's other people out there, someone else out there that's not in this house that, like, gives a shit that, like, you know, can help you with things if you need to, and of course, vice versa. It's been a great, great feeling, and I don't think a bubble arrangement is perfect for a lot of people, maybe even most people, because I think all that stuff I just described about like codifying what you do and then logging it is going to be onerous, if not impossible, for a lot of people. But for us, it's an arrangement that is working right now, and I'm really excited about it. And you should expect to hear more from me about it in the future. But, you know, it does fit into this thing I've been thinking about a lot recently. And I've talked about this in the past. But there is this article that David Brooks wrote in The Atlantic called "The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. The family structure we've held up as the cultural idea for the past century has been a catastrophe for many. It's time to figure out better ways to live together." And in this article, David Brooks lays out the argument that what we conceive of as the nuclear family essentially was a historical accident. Now, I've recommended this article as a weekly recommendation in weeks past, and so I'm sorry. I'm repeating myself a lot this episode, but I want to read a little bit from this article because I think it's so fast. It's really one of those articles. Sometimes I'll read an article or watch a movie that completely shapes how I think of a specific topic, and this is one of those articles. In this article, I'll read, quote, "For a time, it all seemed to work. From 1950 to 1965, divorce rates dropped, fertility rates rose, and the American nuclear family seemed to be in wonderful shape. And most people seemed prosperous and happy. In these years, a kind of cult formed around this type of family, what McCall's, the leading woman's magazine of the day, called togetherness. Healthy people lived in two-parent families. In a 1957 survey, more than half of the respondents said that unmarried people were sick, immoral, or neurotic. During this period, a certain family ideal became engraved in our minds, a married couple with 2.5 kids. When we think of the American family, many of us still revert to this ideal. When we have debates about how to strengthen the family, we're thinking of the two-parent nuclear family with one or two kids, probably living in some detached family home on some suburban street. We take it as the norm, even though this isn't the way most humans have lived during the tens of thousands of years before 1950, and it isn't the way most humans have lived in the 55 years since 1965. Today, only a minority of American households are traditional two-parent nuclear families, and only one-third of American individuals live in this type of family. That 1950 to 65 window was not normal. It was a freakish historical moment when all of society conspired, wittingly or not, to obscure the essential fragility of the nuclear family." I'm going to continue because this is so interesting. "For one thing, most women were relegated to the home. Many corporations, well into the mid-20th century, barred married women from employment. Companies would hire single women, but if those women got married, they would have to quit. Demeaning and disempowering treatment of women was rampant. Women spent enormous numbers of hours trapped inside the home under the headship of their husband, raising children. For another thing, nuclear families in this era were much more connected to other nuclear families than they are today, constituting a modified extended family, as the sociologist Eugene Litwack put it, a coalition of nuclear families in a state of mutual dependence. Even as late as the 1950s, before television and air conditioning had fully caught on, people continued to live on one another's front porches and were part of one another's lives. Friends felt free to discipline one another's children." I'll skip a little bit forward. "Finally, conditions in the wider society were ideal for family stability. The post-war period was a high-water mark for church attendance, unionization, social trust, and mass prosperity, all things that correlate with family cohesion. A man could relatively easily find a job that would allow him to be the breadwinner for a single-income family. By 1961, the median American man, aged 25 to 29, was earning nearly 400% more than his father had earned at about the same age." I'll end quote there. You know, this article is very long, and I think you should read it. But the argument he's making is basically like, we think of the nuclear family, and maybe most people don't even think of it this way. So, like, obviously David Brooks is conservative, and so you may have already thought of the nuclear family as a tool of oppression. So that's fine too. But certainly when I grew up, you know, the idea of the nuclear family was held up as the ideal. Two parents, two kids. You know, I had a brother. And it's always kind of what I imagined for myself moving forward into the future. But Brooks argues rather convincingly that the circumstances that produced the nuclear family were historically unique, and that we as a society should get away from thinking of the nuclear family as like the primary family unit. I have some friends in the Seattle area. I haven't asked them permission to share this story, so I'm going to leave them nameless. But I have a couple friends who I look up to greatly, and they are artists and creative people. And they have recently talked to me about creating a commune, like buying kind of a plot of land with like multiple houses on it and like inviting their friends to live with them on it. My friends are slightly older than I am right now. So they're kind of like later on in their lives. And so many of them and their friends are like empty nesters. And so they're in a different phase of life than me. So this isn't something I'm considering for myself right now. But the idea of living with your friends in a commune, creating things, depending on each other, it strikes me as very, very fascinating and something that should be explored further, because I think good things can come when you open your mind to what is possible in terms of like family arrangements, in terms of like who are the people who are close to you, who are the people who you depend on. Like, a lot of people have a really strict opinion of this. Like, it's my family, it's blood, nothing's more important than blood, you know? And I think that's completely understandable given the way society has organized itself and society has shown like what is valuable. But I also think that it's possible to open yourself up to like different possibilities, given that we are living in a much different time than when the nuclear family was really popularized in the 50s and 60s. And so when I'm forming this COVID bubble, it's kind of a very, 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 very small baby step to like considering and expanding my definition of what a family can be, of what role friends can play in one's life. Anyway, it's just what's going on in my mind. I also read this profile of Chris Rock in the New York Times recently, and he was talking about a similar sentiment. You know, it's got me thinking about this. He was doing a profile in the New York Times because of season 4 of Fargo, and he was talking about his friends, and he got a couple questions. The question asked him was, who do you hang with these days? Who's your peer group? And Chris Rock says, I hang with Dave Chappelle, I hang with my kids, I hang with Nelson George. There's not a lot of hanging in the COVID world. The better question is, who do you FaceTime with? And then he got asked, so who do you FaceTime with? And he said, Chris Rock says, quote, the other day I realized I've never met an elderly person that was cared for by their friends. Every elderly person I know that's got any trouble is cared for by a spouse or child. Sometimes they have like 5 kids, but only one helps. Where are your friends? Your friends are probably not going to be there when it really counts. When my dad was dying in the hospital, where were his friends? My grandmother, where were her friends? Don't get me wrong. You get sick in your 20s, your friends will come to the hospital. It's an adventure. You get sick in your 60s, they farm it out. You go Wednesday, I'll go Sunday. Enjoy them while you have them. But if you think your friends are your long-term solution to loneliness, you're an idiot, end quote. It's kind of an orthogonal point to what I was saying. You know, like, I think Chris Rock is arguing in this piece, to the extent he's arguing anything, he's saying, like, basically any kind of family arrangement outside of your blood is impossible. Or it's certainly not very common right now. And I found that to be also very illuminating and made me think, you know, like, oh, yeah, of older people I know who need care, like, who is taking care of them? It is mostly their family, you know? So it's something that's been on my mind a lot as I'm forming this COVID bubble. You know, we're battening down the hatches. We're going to be in this whole situation for at least another year and probably more. And so we are taking steps we need to kind of survive from a mental health perspective, forming a COVID bubble and making arrangements in that way. And it just made me think of like, hey, what are the assumptions about society should I personally revisit? All right, so that's kind of the COVID component of this podcast, but let's talk about some other things that have been happening. I want to talk about a couple things I've been watching recently. I mentioned this on the Slash Filmcast, but I want to go a little bit more in depth here on Culturally Relevant. So, last week, as I mentioned, work has been really intense. So when I get to the weekend, I'm basically like completely, my mind is completely devastated. Like, I just need to do nothing, you know. Unfortunately, that's not even possible this weekend for reasons I'll get into later. But like, but yeah, last weekend I was just like so mentally exhausted that I just said, okay, I'm just gonna watch a lot of stuff. I'm just gonna sit on the couch and watch lots of stuff. And that's exactly what I did last week. I decided to explore my Criterion catalog a little bit and the Criterion channel subscription that I have. And so I started watching a bunch of Criterion stuff. And obviously, there's a lot of good stuff on there. Criterion channel is amazing. I have, until last week, I'd never opened up my Criterion channel app because I have so many other things to watch, things that are coming out, you know, new every week. And that's obviously slowed down a lot in the last few months because theatrical film going has gone away. So because theatrical film going has gone away, like releases on home video, video on demand has slowed down. You're not, you know, at this moment in time, like in an alternate universe where COVID didn't happen, we would already have Black Widow, No Time to Die, the new James Bond movie, and maybe even Fast and Furious already out on video on demand. But because we live in a COVID world, none of those movies came out in theaters. None of those movies are on video on demand. And so the video on demand world has slowed down quite a bit. So I finally, I've been, you know, paying for this Criterion channel for a while. And I finally thought, hey, I should check it out. I use the Criterion channel app on my Apple TV. And I think the Criterion channel is so valuable because so many other streaming services do not have old movies. Like if you look at Netflix, like the number of movies they have that were released before 1980 is vanishingly small. And we need things like the Criterion channel to preserve film culture, to preserve film history. So it's super, super valuable, even though I have never watched it until recently. But I watched a couple movies that I want to mention real quick and talk a little bit about. And you should assume that if I mention the movie, I'm going to describe the plot in detail. So like, if you don't want to know the plots of these like 20-plus-year-old movies, then be aware, spoilers up ahead for the movies that I'm going to mention from the Criterion Channel. First movie from the Criterion Channel, Christopher Nolan's Following. This movie came out in 1998. And it was Christopher Nolan's first movie. I think it was made for a budget of like $10,000 or something like that. It was very low budget. And it's about a young man who is bored and he is a writer and he's looking for inspiration. So he starts following people around and he just wants to see what they're doing. And he eventually starts to make rules like never follow people more than once. Don't follow people at night, like things like that. But of course, he eventually ends up breaking his rules. One of the guys he follows is a guy named Cobb. He's played by Alex Haw. This is interesting. Alex Haw plays this guy named Cobb. He's very handsome. He's very charismatic. I looked him up, and I mean, when I'm on the Wikipedia page for Following, he doesn't even have a Wikipedia page because he's apparently not really an actor. He doesn't meet their notability standards. And I thought why isn't this guy like a very famous actor? He has an IMDb page, but it's just so interesting that this guy, Alex Haw, I think he primarily identifies as an artist and architect. So that's why he's not listed in Wikipedia as having a film career. But anyway, I just thought Alex Haw, like, given that most of these movies, like, and this one as well, the acting is not necessarily, A-list, because it's obviously like a very low budget movie, and I'm not trying to look down at all. I'm just saying like Christopher Nolan works with literally the best actors alive today. So like this is his start. He was not working with the best actors alive at this point in time. Anyway, I thought Alex Haw did a great job as Cobb, and obviously the name Cobb would come to be known as Dom Cobb's, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio's character in Inception. Both of them play thieves in this movie. So this character Cobb confronts the protagonist when, like, the young man who's following everyone around. One of them is Cobb, and Cobb like sits down next to him at a coffee shop and says, "Hey, why are you following me?" And he's like, "I'm not following you." And then Cobb says, like, "You're really bad at this," and essentially says, "Do you want to see what's in this bag? Because you keep looking at this bag I'm carrying around." And the young man who's following Cobb around says, "Yes, I'd like to see what's in the bag." He opens up the bag and he finds that Cobb has stolen a bunch of CDs, because back then when this movie came out, it was easy to flip CDs for profit. Now you need to pay people to take them away from you. But today, in the age of this movie, you could flip CDs. Turns out Cobb is a thief. And he goes into people's houses and he rifles through their things And he takes, he like, he fucks with them. He like takes them away, or, you know, he'll like go through their personal effects and like remove something valuable to them. And I'm going to read it from the Wikipedia plot summary. Cobb explains his true passion is using the shock of robbery and violation of property to make his victims re-examine their lives. He sums up his attitude thus: you take it away and you show them what they had. And you take it away and show them what they had. End quote. And I thought that was really fascinating, you know, because Cobb's whole philosophy is, when you take something away from them, you cause them to revisit whether or not they needed it in the first place. And, you know, like, you steal their stereo system, or you steal their turntable, or you steal their, you know, Fleetwood Mac collection or whatever. And then, A, they feel really violated and Cobb seems to get off on that. But B, they need to decide whether they're going to replace that Fleetwood Mac, you know, record collection. They need to decide whether they're going to replace the turntable. They need to decide whether they're going to replace the speaker set. And in doing so, they reevaluate all the decisions that led them to that point. And Cobb seems to really revel in forcing people to think about this, right? He is delighted that he gets to psychologically toy with his victims like this, even in their in his absence. Like, he's not around when it happens. And I guess I feel like, in a way, you know, I know this is going to sound lame and cheesy, but for me, it's true. The pandemic has been like a thief. It's been like a cob. It's robbed us of so many things in our lives. And what the pandemic has done, it has just taken things away, and it's showing us what we had. And it's making us reconsider all the decisions that have led us to the point where we are right now, all the decisions we've made. It's torn down the structure of our lives, and it's made us reflect on whether or not we actually needed most of that structure. Did we need all those things? And it's made us reconsider. You know, and for many institutions and, you know, people who are like companies who are saying, like, you can work from home right now, you know, like, companies are reconsidering, like, to what extent they require people to be in the office right now. People are reconsidering to what extent they needed to see all the people they saw or do all the things they did. It's taken things away. It's showing us what we had. Anyway, the movie goes on. It turns out Cobb was actually trying to entice the young man to follow him, to ensnare him in an extremely elaborate game that would then end up going to Cobb's benefit. And, you know, I'll leave it ambiguous as to whether or not it actually plays out as Cobb plans. But love how you get to see the kind of spirits, the seeds, the inception, as it were, of Christopher Nolan's bigger ideas in Following. There's nonlinear storytelling. There is multiple twists. There is brooding dude. There even is dead significant other in this movie. And so it's like many of the things that would go on to become hallmarks of the Christopher Nolan style are definitely present in this movie. And it's fascinating that he went from making this no budget movie, where the biggest expense was the cost of the film, the 16 millimeter film stock he shot on, to now, you know, he is able to make movies that have a budget of $200 million that have all happened in the last two decades. But you could totally see he was a visionary at the time. A lot of people look down on this movie. They think it's like not very good. I really enjoyed it. I surprisingly enjoyed it, because it's just like, hey, it shows you that all you need to make a movie is a really good idea and some decent execution. And with that, you can really make something that interests people. So anyway, that's Following. Another thing I watched is I checked out the Albert Brooks collection. And I have to say, Drew McWeeny over at his newsletter, Formerly Dangerous, wrote about the Albert Brooks collection, and I love Drew McWeeny's writing, and so I was like, I'm going to check out some Albert Brooks movies. Couldn't get through most of them. I actually literally started multiple Albert Brooks movies, and I just found them, I found the characters he plays to be so unlikable and unpleasant, intentionally so, that I'm just like, I can't spend time with this person. I already spend time with this person a lot, and it's me. No, I'm just joking. I'm not quite like the Albert Brooks characters, but there's many parts of these Albert Brooks characters that remind me of myself, so I'm like, dude, I don't need more of this in my life. And so I literally started like four Albert Brooks movies, watched for like 30 minutes, and was like, I can't finish this. But I did watch one that I did get to the end of, and that was Lost in America, a 1985 road film starring Albert Brooks and Julie Haggerty. Where Albert Brooks and Julie Haggerty play David and Linda Howard. They're kind of these yuppie characters who work in the corporate world. And they're like, you know what? We're gonna sell everything we have and live off the land. And so they're working in like nice successful jobs, and they sell everything, and they actually literally just bought a house, but they sell the new house and they buy a mobile home, and they're like, we're going to ride around the country and survive off of the remnants of the money from what we sold, which I think is somewhere between $140,000 and $200,000 back in 1980s days. And we're going to just live off of that for a really long time. And that's what the rest of our lives are going to be. It's going to be that forever. Now, we as the audience are meant to laugh at these people. Like, they're meant to come off as dumb and oblivious. So, you know, obviously, it's a very bad plan. What are they going to... It's a plan that's born out of emotion and not of intelligence. It's not like they really thought through the implications of what's going to actually happen when we spend all this time out there. You know, like, let's say you spend... Let's say you're able to survive off this money for 10 years. Then what? It's hard to get a job when you've been out of the working world for 10 years and... and then you have no money left at that point. You know, so it's like they haven't thought this through, and the movie shows why they haven't thought this through. They go to Las Vegas as one of their first destinations, and they go to the Desert Inn Casino in Las Vegas. And because Julie Haggard is like, hey, we're gonna get remarried tomorrow morning in the Las Vegas chapel. Let's go all out, spend the night in Vegas. So they go to the Desert Inn Casino and they stay there, and they get the mini honeymoon suite, which has like two little heart-shaped beds rather than one big heart-shaped bed. After bribing the cashier at the front desk, they get like this honeymoon suite. One thing that really struck me looking at this movie was like how shitty this hotel is compared to modern day Vegas hotels. Like, you go to modern day Vegas hotels, they are like freaking palaces. It's like very, very modern, very nice, and it's like everything in this Desert Inn. Granted, the Desert Inn Casino is not necessarily like high end to begin with, but like I was just like, wow, this is like looks like a fairly depressing place, even back in the 80s. Like, I would think, like, in, you know, decades ago, it's a heyday of this type. But anyway, so they stay at the Desert Inn Casino. They're really high on life. They're going to wake up early the next day and recommit themselves at a Vegas chapel, and before driving out into the rest of the world and enjoying their basically early retirement. Albert Brooks' character David Howard wakes up the next morning. His wife is gone. And he's like, where did she go? He goes downstairs to the casino, because many of these hotels have, you know, they're hotels built on top of casinos. And he sees Julie Haggerty playing roulette by herself, basically. And Gary Marshall is there, who's brilliant as a casino manager in this movie. And he takes David Howard aside. He says, hey, You got to talk to her. You got to talk to your wife here. She's down a lot. So David Howard pulls Linda away. You know, Albert Brooks pulls Julie Haggerty away, and they talk about it. And it turns out she's lost all of their money. all of their remaining funds, all the $150,000, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars that they had planned to use for the rest of their lives, she literally lost it all in one night. And this is a hilarious situation that's ripe for comedy. I mean, he is so pissed, right? And he's like, I didn't even know you had a gambling problem. And she says, I literally didn't know either. I've never gambled before in my entire life. But she, apparently she was up by $100,000 at one point. And, you know, sometimes when you're riding that dragon, you just got to ride it all the way down. And so, yeah. So what happens after that is a pretty hilarious sequence of events. And really, like, each of these big arguments that Albert Brooks has with these people. Like, he didn't get a promotion at his job, so he kind of blows up and has a meltdown, Jerry Maguire style. That's kind of like a set piece in this movie. And another set piece is, like, Albert Brooks going to the casino manager, played by Gary Marshall, and trying to convince them to give him his money back in an extremely painfully awkward scene that goes on for a very, very long time. And it's amazing. It's really, really, really funny, and it's painful, and it's uncomfortable, and it's also very amusing. And there's multiple like set pieces like that throughout the rest of the film, where, like, it's just literally Albert Brooks going on an extended rant. He just goes on all these extended rants. He, like, yells at Julie Haggerty for an extended rant at one point. That's very, very funny. And finally, the two of them find themselves at this kind of mobile home community in Safford, Arizona. And they need to find money. They need to make money so they can survive, so they can live, because they don't have any food or anything like that. And so they're like, let's just go around in Safford and see if we can get a job. So David Howard goes to a pharmacy in Safford, Arizona, and it says, like, hey, I was looking for the delivery man job out front. You said in your wanted sign, your help wanted sign. And the guy behind the counter says, oh, I was more looking for, like, a teenager who could help me. And also, do you have a car? And David Howard says, well, I don't have a car, but I have a mobile home. I have a Winnebago that I bought to drive around the country. And he says, I honestly couldn't, the cashier says, I honestly couldn't pay you enough to even gas up that mobile home, let alone actually, like, make money. But you may want to try the employment office down the street. So David Howard goes to the employment office down the street, and the employment officer there says, hey, so tell me about, like, what kind of job you're looking for. Because, you know, the guy who's at this employment office in Safford, Arizona, is used to people, like, wanting to work, like, a waiter job, wanting to work as a, you know, and they have this really, really funny conversation where David Howard says, like, oh, you know, I've worked at one of the biggest ad agencies in the world for the last 80 years. And he's like, the employment officer says, okay, so how much money did you make? And he's like, well, about $85,000, but then, like, with a bonus could be an additional, like, 15 or 25. So let's call it 100. And the employment officer is stunned because he's never had anyone walk into his office that makes this much money. And so he says, I'm sorry, like, what period of time did you make $100,000? And he's like, A year is how long it took me to make $100,000. And so then the employment officer is, like, really interested in, like, what drove this person to come here. You know, like, did he come here? And he jokes, like, do you come here to double up on your $100,000? And David Howard says, I've come here to live. I've come here to change my life. And the employment officer responds, you couldn't change it on $100,000? It's a question that hangs in the air because David Howard has no answer for it. And I think in a way, this movie kind of holds up a mirror to those of us in the corporate world, right? And it's like, what is it really you're looking for? And in your idealized scenario, like, how would it actually play out, you know? I don't think I've really had the fantasy of, like, driving around the country in a Winnebago. Like, that honestly sounds terrifying to me. I think if you're not a white person, it's probably pretty scary to do that. But yeah, I think that the idea of, you know, quitting the job and, like, living off the land, or, you know, doing like being a creative person for a living, has definitely held strong appeal to me. And movie like Lost in America makes me reconsider, like, how dumb I am, you know, like how oblivious I am, whether I am oblivious or not. I don't know. It's just a thought-provoking movie, and it has a lot of great laughs. And so it's the one Albert Brooks movie that I made it through. It's called Lost in America. And I saw it on the Criterion Channel. I had a great time with it. So that's following Lost in America. That's what I've been watching and thinking about. I want to close by talking about, you know, I usually have a weekly recommendation. And I want to close by talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart. Something that's... that is honestly a joy, but has also added a great deal to my stress in the last couple weeks, which is that I am launching a new season of the Tobolowsky Files this Monday, along with Stephen Tobolowsky. Now, I don't know what percentage of the audience that is listening to this audio right now even knows about the Tobolowsky Files, but for those who don't know, the Tobolowsky Files is a podcast I created, I don't know, 8 years ago with actor Stephen Tobolowsky. Every episode is just him telling stories from his life. Working with Stephen Tobolowsky has been one of the most meaningful, amazing, incredible working relationships / friendships I've ever had. It's been a blessing to be able to work with him and to make this, to make these things. The Tobolowsky Files is not the most popular podcast I have created, but it is the one that I think has had the most impact on the people who've listened to it. People have written in so many times with stories about how they've been moved and affected and their lives changed by Stephen's stories. And it's really gratifying to see it. It's really gratifying to know that, you know, I've made something that, or I've been part of making something that, can help people in some way, you know, that can stimulate people in some way, make them think in some way. So I hope you'll consider checking out the Tobolowsky Files when it returns at tobolowskyfiles.com. Starting this Monday, there will be new episodes. Starting Monday, September 28th, there will be new episodes every Monday for throughout the end of the year, throughout the rest of 2020. So one good thing to come out of this year, at least. In addition, I have also filmed some of Stephen's stories live in front of a studio audience, in front of a theater audience. And we filmed these pre-COVID. I want to tell you a little bit about my experience making The Primary Instinct. So I made a movie called The Primary Instinct. We kickstarted it. And it's basically just a concert film with Stephen Tobolowsky. And I'm very proud of that movie. I think it's very moving and powerful. And I am very fortunate that I got to make a movie that I didn't go into debt for. You know, it was crowdfunded, and it even got picked up by for distribution by Film Buff, which is now called Gunpowder and Sky. It was acquired by a company called Gunpowder and Sky. And I feel very fortunate that like any of that happened. You know, like many people, they make their own film, and it they go into debt because of it. It never gets any distribution at all. Like right now, I think to this moment, you can watch The Primary Instinct on Amazon Prime, if I'm not mistaken. So it's, you know, I feel very, very fortunate that I was able to do any of these things. I do also want to acknowledge that I had kind of like bigger ambitions for Primary Instinct, you know? I was hoping it would get picked up by Netflix. Film Buff took it to Netflix and they said no. Because I really felt like if Netflix was able to expose Stephen's stories to a wider audience, it would get a lot of traction that way. I still believe that, to be honest. And that didn't happen. And I was very, very discouraged by that. And not only was I very discouraged, but I learned so much from making The Primary Instinct. But one of those things is that you need to put as much work into marketing and distributing the film. If you're doing it indie style like we did, you need to put as much work into that as you did into making the film. And I didn't really realize that. I thought like, hey, I'll make this film, you know, which is like an enormous undertaking. And then like, I'm going to try to get it distributed and like, they'll put it out there and, you know. But really, you need to put as, like, when you're done making the film, which, by the way, has taken hundreds of hours of your life, you are only at best 50% of the way there. And I didn't realize that at first. And so in the time since then, I've continued to make podcast episodes with Steven. And I filmed a bunch of Steven's stuff because I thought, hey, let's film some of the stuff and maybe it'll get traction online. But I haven't put it out online. Like, I shot a story with Steven like 2-3 years ago. And I really liked how it turned out, but I never released it publicly. And the reason I never released it publicly is because I felt this enormous weight of, what if I fuck this up? And what I mean by that is, you only get one chance to release something. Like, people can find an, like, you know, people are still finding the Primary Instinct to this day. Maybe you will listen to this and watch the Primary Instinct. So it's really great that what's amazing about movies is, like, people can find movies long after they're released and still have a beautiful, provocative experience with them. You know, like, that's what's amazing about movies is, like, they're preserved in amber kind of in some ways. You change, but the movie stays the same. But what I realized, like, you can only release something once, and if I fuck this up, if I don't roll this content out in the right way, we'll miss kind of an opportunity. So I thought to myself, okay, Dave, film this stuff with Steven, put it off until a time when you can really make a concerted PR push around it. And that's what we're doing next week. You know, I don't know how successful this is going to be. You know, like, I have no idea. Like, I think we've gotten Steven, like, several interviews with some publications that I admire. We're going to do a big Reddit Ask Me Anything on Tuesday, September 29th. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm actually going to take a day off work just to work on this. But, yeah, I mean, this is a big push we're making. And I don't know if I'm being very coherent, but what I'm trying to say is basically that, like, again, it's one thing to make something and put it on the internet. It's another thing to get people to give a shit about it. And the second part, to me, is actually not necessarily harder, but, like, equally difficult. Because getting people to give a shit about the thing you've made in this incredibly saturated media environment is really, really, really tough. And you need to be really, really creative, and you need to work your ass off to do it. And I've been working really hard at my job, but also obviously at the Patreon page and also on this podcast. And now I'm about to launch this podcast next week with, like, a really concerted PR push. I want to give a big shout out to Tyler, if he's listening to this, Tyler S., who has been one of my listeners and who has helped me with the PR for this, because just out of the goodness of his heart. And, you know, there's a lot of people who have made this new Tobolowsky stuff possible. Valentina V, for instance, who has helped to film video versions. So basically, I'm, again, at this point in the podcast, I'm, like, completely rambling incoherent. But next week, on Monday, we're publishing new episodes of the Tobolowsky Files. We're also publishing a new YouTube channel for the Tobolowsky Files, which is going to have, like, the stories that we filmed, and we're going to make a concerted PR push around both. Steven will probably be the guest on the podcast, this podcast, next week, and he's going to guest on a couple of other pod. You know, we're really going to try to get some attention to this, and it's really, like, the best I can. It's the best I can do. You know, it's at this point in my life, it's like, hey, we're going to put this out there. We're going to put as much PR behind it, and hopefully people will find it. But it's better than just putting it out there and then not doing any work and hoping for the best. Cause that's just, I've seen how that goes before and it doesn't go very well. So anyway, that is what is happening next week. And, the point I'm making is just that, like, there's a lot going on right now, and I'm working really hard. We've been working for months to put this together, and I hope you'll check it out. Again, it's at tobolowskyfiles.com or at youtube.com/tobofiles. But I also just wanted to give you some insight into, like, why I'm doing it this way. You know, I'm not just, like, releasing it and saying, like, if you build it, they will come. They will not come. No one's going to come see your thing if you build it. Or at least most of the time, you know, unless your thing is like extremely shareable, which it may be, but like otherwise no one's going to come. And so you need to like figure out ways to get them to come. And that's what I've been working on. And I hope people come. But if not, it's going to be out there and hopefully people will find it as time goes on. So, all right. I think that's going to bring us to the end of today's episode. I'm sorry, got a little weird at the end there, but I appreciate you sticking with it, and I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast. I am so grateful to people over at patreon.com/DaveChen for supporting me. Some people have signed up and then canceled because they can only support me for a little bit of time. Just know that I'm extremely grateful for that as well. You know, like if you felt like you could support me for any little amount of time, it means a lot, but... never feel bad about not supporting me, never feel bad about canceling, but for those who can support me at patreon.com/DaveChen, it really does mean a lot. It gives me the motivation, the inspiration to keep going, to keep making the show, and I hope it means a lot to you. So if it does, patreon.com/DaveChen, or if you want to support this podcast without spending any money, share about it on social media, leave a podcast review at Apple Podcasts. It just takes a few seconds and it really does help me out. Find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com and email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. Follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. Thanks for listening. See you next week.